Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear the third part of a speech by CIA whistleblower Susan Lindauer given in Seattle in September of 2011. Susan Lindauer wrote the book Extreme Prejudice, The Terrifying Story of the Patriot Act and the Cover-Ups of 9/11 and Iraq, The Ultimate Conspiracy to Silence Truth, which came out in 2010. There are mixed reactions to Susan within the 9/11 truth community. Her belief that the planes that hit the towers were really hijacked by Middle Eastern men, and her belief that the government let the attacks happen on purpose or LIHOP rather than made them happen on purpose or MIHOP, are two points of contention. Some think she's still working for the CIA. Others embrace her fully. Today you can listen to what she has to say and judge for yourself. Much of her presentation in Seattle involved a Q&A with the audience, and one of the topics mentioned is Operation Northwoods. And I'm going to give a brief description of that for those of you who may not know about it. Operation Northwoods was created to generate a pretext for an unprovoked war on Cuba. This happened in 1962. And here's what author Paul Rhea says in his book Mounting Evidence, Why We Need a New Investigation into 9/11, which came out in 2010. The Joint Chiefs planned deceptions in the skies that involved substituting a drone aircraft for a commercial flight and then destroying it through remote control. The plan called for staging an incident which will demonstrate convincingly that a Cuban aircraft has attacked and shot down a chartered civil airliner. With CIA agents posing as passengers, an airliner was to head for Cuba, but the plane would secretly land in a CIA airfield. Here it would receive a new tail number, making it seem like a different airliner. Then it was to take off, ready to veer off when a duplicate but unmanned airliner took its place in midair. The substitute drone airliner would be flown by remote control toward Cuba, sending back pre-recorded calls for help. Then came the climactic blowout of the plot. When over Cuba, the generals proposed, the drone will begin transmitting on the international distress frequency a Mayday message stating he is under attack by Cuban MiG aircraft. The transmission will be interrupted by destruction of the aircraft, which will be triggered by radio signal. This will allow Latin American radio stations to tell the United States what's happened to the aircraft instead of the U.S. trying to sell the incident. Having blamed Havana for the atrocity, Washington could proceed with the invasion it had longed to execute. Admiral Lyman Lemnitzer, chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the main proponent of the Northwoods plot, presented it to Defense Secretary McNamara and President Kennedy. After both rejected the scheme, Admiral Lemnitzer sought to destroy all evidence of the Northwoods plan. So that's Operation Northwoods in a nutshell. So let's get started now with the third part of Susan Lindauer's presentation in Seattle in September of 2011.
Did the feds kind of lean on the peace community in Washington to separate themselves from the 9/11 truth-seeking community, not the conspiracy community, the truth-seeking community, and pressure them to step away from this issue? I can tell you that one of the groups that did not, that refused to do it, was the DC Anti-War Network. And God love these folks. They were really good on my issue, and they stood up for me. And they started asking some questions like, what does Susan Lindauer know that the government is trying to hide? And what is her involvement with 9/11? There are rumors here that she warned about 9/11, because within the Washington community there was talk about it. That peace group was then subjected to the Patriot Act. In Maryland and in the D.C. Anti-War Network was infiltrated by the FBI and by Maryland State Police. They were subjected to heavy wiretapping, all the constraints that go with the Patriot Act, like secret warrantless searches. All of these things were then done to these people, citing the Patriot Act. And so the fact that they tried to investigate 9/11 meant they were subjected to the Patriot Act as well. And that's a really good example. Where is the money going? Your question is, to sum it up, is, you know, I'm talking about $75 billion for surveillance, and it's a small amount when we're losing big amounts. And where is the money going? And I don't know. I truly don't know. You know, we're financing these wars, and the wars are very profitable for KBR, for Blackwater, for Halliburton, and some people are making out. They're so wealthy. You had asked, was the Oklahoma City building wired, the Alfred P. Murrow building wired? What we do know is that the ATF, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Agency, did not show up for work that day. It appears that they had infiltrated the Timothy McVeigh Waco group and that they had received some sort of advance warning and that they protected themselves by not going to work that day. I can tell you that my own defense intelligence handler, Paul Hoven, believed that was true and that he studied the architectural layout for the building and he swore, and he gave debriefings on Capitol Hill, and he swore there was no way a truck bomb could have produced the extent of the damage in that configuration of damage, that it had to be wired from inside the stairwells and inside the elevator shafts, and that that would be the only way to achieve that style of detonation. He was convinced of it.
Here, a member of the audience has asked if there's a paper trail or documentation on the prior knowledge of 9/11 or about the peace framework concerning Iraq that Susan Lindauer was working on.
The peace framework is documented in 11 letters to Andy Card, which track the progression of the talks. And the letters ran from November 2000, right after the vote count, all the way to December 2001, when we had Iraq's total agreement with the language according to the demands of the CIA. The CIA would like wanted weapons inspections with no conditions. There were some technical points of negotiation that had been refined by this point. But yeah, there's a paper trail of the peace framework, which is what frightened them. The 9/11 stuff is known through witness testimony, but they're very credible witnesses. I will tell you one other thing, which is interesting. The New York Times, I was arrested in March of 2004, and the New York Times wrote a scathing article about me. And so it was very interesting. They wrote a scathing, horrible, horrible article. But they had confirmed through four sources that I had warned about 9/11. My CIA handler told them, my defense intelligence handler told them, my brother told them, and Park Godfrey told them. Who was a university professor at York University in Toronto, and he teaches computer science, and he's a very precise, methodical speaker. He's not an activist. He's not a passionate man. He's more like Dr. Spock from Star Trek. But the New York Times would not print the story and instead attacked me when they found out.
Next, she's responding to a question about the New York Times and why they would not print her warning about 9/11.
The New York Times had been a major champion of the war, and they were protecting the politicians who had put themselves on the line in supporting the war over the objections of the people. Every major news outlet did the same thing. We're talking about CNN, countdown to Saddam, showdown with Iraq. Americans were glued to our television set waiting for this terrible war to happen. And they were looking for ratings. And I consider it unforgivable and very destructive to the political accountability that CNN and MSNBC and Fox News Channel allowed our politicians to grandstand on 9/11 and pretend they were doing something on terrorism. Politicians in Washington don't do anything on terrorism. They provide lousy oversight. They provide money that is being lost. They don't know where the money's going. They don't know how it's being spent. They have no auditing authority. They're not doing a good job on terrorism. But the politicians are out there saying, "Ooh, look at me, I've got the flag behind me, and it's so pretty now, and everyone's paying attention," and they get to be charismatic leaders of our country, and it's not true.
And here, a gentleman from the audience has stated that there's a movement for a one-world government, and that they have organizations in the U.S., like the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission, and internationally, the Bilderberg Group. And his question was, how much of our intelligence agencies have been infiltrated by these organizations?
All of it. All of it. And the other thing that's happening, and this is a difficulty, and this is something that we're going to have to get to a point where we can debate, and that is that we are making foreign policy that's good for other nations, that's not necessarily good for us. And I think that we know what some of those other countries are. And we have to decide if that's really in our best interest to do, or if we need to start focusing on what's good for America, because it's not the same thing.
And next she's asked, whatever happened to the plane that did not hit the Pentagon? Where did it go? Who was on it? And where are they?
I do not know. What I do believe is that there was no plane that hit the Pentagon. I don't think there was a plane that hit the Pentagon. I think that somebody got excited and fired off a missile at the Pentagon. Maybe overreacted.
The same gentleman states that in the Northwoods documents, they were going to load the planes with CIA assets with false names. Susan Lindauer immediately jumps in with the following.
I'm really glad you mentioned this about the false passports, because one of the reasons that I don't get upset about the names of these people, some of the people who were allegedly killed in the terrorist attack were found by their families months later. Okay, they're still alive. The other thing is, these people could easily have used false passports. There's no evidence that they would have used their own names. And these were not jihadis who were dedicated to Islamic conservatism. They gambled, they partied, they went to strip joints, they threw money around. They didn't act like devout religious men who were on a mission to escalate Islam and to raise Islam as a supremacist religion. The Islamic people that I know wouldn't support that kind of philosophy anyway. It's more like this was something that you had assets. I cannot stress this enough. Assets are heavily supervised. They bug your phones. They follow you. They track your meetings. When I'd have a meeting with the Iraqis or the Libyans, whether I went to a restaurant, if I had a meeting in the embassy, there'd be 10 people close by watching everything I did. And you're telling me that they planned a terrorist attack and none of these handlers picked up on it? That's just the most absurd thing I've ever heard of in my life. And the fact is, we did know about it because we were talking about it all the time. We talked about it constantly. It was a constant discussion.
Next, a woman asks, how long did you work in intelligence? And when did you become aware of the terrible attitude and complicity of the intelligence community?
Well, from day one. I covered the Iraqi embassy and the Libyan embassy from 1995 until 2003. So for almost 8 years, I did it. And I knew from day one that I was a very controversial choice. I was an anti-war activist, like you guys. I was an anti-sanctions activist. So the Libyans and the Iraqis loved me. They knew also what I was doing. This was not, I gotta stress, this was not a covert thing where I was just like sneaking around their embassy. They knew what I was there to do and that I was there to communicate messages back and forth, and they would take advantage of it and they would receive the messages and they would give the messages. One of the things that came out in my case was that I was accused of being severely paranoid, and they said that I was worried that people might be having me like surveillance in my house. Well, let me tell you, there was surveillance in my house. When Libya handed over the men, the two men for the Lockerbie trial, on that day, I went down to my basement, and somebody had come into my house and had ripped out the ceiling tiles of my basement, and there were about a dozen cable wires, audio cable wires, dangling down from the ceiling. And I had a contractor come in and look at it to try to fix it. He said, wow, somebody had a stereo system. They've got this wired all through your house. These audio wires are going to every room in your house, even your bathrooms and such. I was not surprised. I was pretty much aware of what was going on.
And now she's asked, to what extent do you think our government is unique? Is this going on around the world? In every country, or are we supreme, or is it equal in other countries?
I think that the CIA would like to pretend that it is the most supreme intelligence agency in the world. I don't think that's true. MI6 is vicious. MI6 will just assassinate you. For example, the Rupert Murdoch case and the hacking case that they've got, there have been 3 or 4 deaths They've talked about one death in the American media, but there's actually been three or four people who died who were exposing the Rupert Murdoch story, and they're all dead people now. And MI6 just goes in and just ices those. I wouldn't go to Britain today. I probably will not go back to Britain for another decade. The British don't like me either.
And now she's asked if the British government will try to get Rupert Murdoch off the hook.
If they could, they're going to get Murdoch off the hook because he's so powerful and so wealthy, and they're going to find a way for him to exit gracefully, and they'll find a way to protect him. They'll always get us, and they'll always protect them.
Next, a woman asks, what do you know about this Libya business that we're dealing with now?
I am up to my eyeballs in the Libya stuff. Last summer, when I was about to publish my book, I was checking with my old friends and fellow assets, and they told me that Gaddafi was in the process of pushing the United States and British oil companies for compensation for the sanctions that Libya had suffered under the Lockerbie attack. The United Nations had Libya under sanctions for about 7 or 8 years, and the Lockerbie bombing actually involved CIA infiltration of heroin trafficking in the Bekaa Valley of Lebanon. And the CIA had been taking kickbacks in exchange, major kickbacks, in exchange for making sure that heroin shipments could pass through customs without checking. Okay? And ostensibly, they were trying to find out who was holding the hostages, Terry Anderson, Terry Waite, Jerry Levin, some very high-profile Western hostages. So they had a reason, like a lot of intelligence stuff, there was a reason why they did it. But somebody on the CIA side was actually a double agent who was telling the hostage takers, the Islamic Jihad folks, whenever the CIA was going to close in and rescue the hostages, so then they'd be moved. So Terry Anderson ended up being held for 7 years. So when we finally get to the Lockerbie trial, one Libyan is acquitted and one is convicted. And it turned out that the United States had bribed witnesses with $4 million payments apiece to testify against Libya. And the men who gave the testimony admitted they received the payments and recanted their testimony. And then at that point, Abdel Basset Megrahi was released from prison, allegedly on a compassionate release for cancer. He had stage 4 prostate cancer. He's still alive. He never died. But the real reason was that the British wanted him to drop his appeal because it was going to expose that the United States had done these terrible things and was heavily involved in the heroin trafficking coming out of the Bekaa Valley. And Gaddafi last summer began to pressure the U.S. oil companies to pay kickbacks to Libya to compensate for the suffering to the Libyan economy from the sanctions. And Libya had been forced to pay $2.7 billion in damages to the Lockerbie families. And maybe the oil companies could help support and provide some money back to Libya. Well, I remember last summer, I don't think this war is funny at all. I'm very offended by it, and I don't want to make it sound like I think that it's a joke. But last summer, when I was hearing about this, I was like, oh, the United States is going to be so mad. What does Gaddafi think he's doing? He thinks he's going to blackmail the United States? And tragedy has resulted from it. And I don't think it's funny anymore, but last summer we didn't know what they were going to do. But I'm convinced this was on the books since about October. Occidental Petroleum pulled out of Libya in October, and I think as soon as they did that, this became a done deal, that the United States was going to go in and push Gaddafi out and put somebody else in. I also believe that the NATO rebels are guilty of war crimes. They are Islamic radicals. We are fighting Islamic radicals in Afghanistan, and we're supporting them in Benghazi. And they want to bring back the abaya. I don't know if you know what the abaya is. That's the black headdress for Islamic women. It's for very conservative Islamic women. They want to take away women's rights. Right now, Gaddafi, you may hate Gaddafi. He's a dictator. He's been in office for 40 years. Yes, all that's true. However, He also has one of the best track records on women's rights in the entire Middle East. Women have the right to reject marriage. They have the right to get an education and hold a job and participate in the economy. They are not beholden to their husbands. They have a great deal of freedom compared to what other Islamic women have. And like Iraq, yeah. And we side with Saudi Arabia and Kuwait.
And here, a gentleman from the audience said he wanted to point out that there were five dancing Israelis that had a camera set up ahead of time that filmed the entire event, and that Judge Mukasey and Michael Chertoff, their lawyer, got them sent back to Israel. And he also points out that there was a lot of Mossad activity in 9/11.
I am aware of that. And I am convinced that Israel had absolute knowledge of 9/11 in advance, in the most advanced detail and the most precise detail. And my situation was giving the United States a measure of deniability, because then they could say that they were trying to get Iraq to give us the information. Of course, Iraq didn't have any information. Really and truly, I can assure you that if Iraq had had that information, I spelled it out to them that it would be to their best interest to give it to us. They would have benefited. They were willing to let the FBI come in and get the information from their people. But the Israelis had that information already and possessed it. And the question is, did they give the information to us and did we ignore it like we ignored everybody else? Or did they hide it? And that's what's unknown. Because it's very possible that they did tell us, and we just didn't care, which would be par for the course.
And next, a gentleman asks for clarification on her cousin Andrew Carr, who was the chief of staff for the Bush administration, what his involvement was with her work in Iraq.
The White House, Andrew Carr, and Colin Powell were totally informed every step of the way of what was going on. This was not a situation where I was just reporting to my CIA handler and telling him updates of what was going on with the Iraqi peace framework. I made sure that the White House itself had that information, and I was delivering every single paper to them as well. And Colin Powell had it. And Colin Powell made a fib when he lied to Barbara Walters and told her that no one tried to scare him off his big speech before the United Nations. I actually had gone to him a week before that speech and gave him papers and gave him an analysis of what was going to happen as a consequence of war. And at that point, by March of 2002, a year before the invasion, Iraq had offered an extraordinary package of democratic reforms as well. That was the last piece of the puzzle. In March of 2002, they offered to have the Iraqi exiles return to Baghdad and be housed in embassy compounds, expanded embassy domiciles. Embassy domiciles are sovereign territory of the home country. So Iraq had pointed out that if they attacked anyone living in such a place, it would be an act of war against that host country. And so they said they're going to be safe here. They can set up a base for political organizations. They can have campaign headquarters. They can participate in elections. We will invite Jimmy Carter to come out and attend elections in Baghdad, and we'll have internationally monitored elections with special protections for the exiles so that they can be reabsorbed into the society. And Andy Card knew all of that, too. There was a lot more that it went way beyond the weapons inspections. The United States wanted to have everything for their own advantage with no punishments for 13 years of sanctions.
And here, someone asks her to speak about PSYOPs, or psychological operations.
The PSYOPs and the dumbing down of America is a tragedy. It's an insult to us as if we're not capable of thinking. It's almost, a reverse compliment, because obviously they're afraid of what's going to happen if we have knowledge. They're afraid of what's going to happen if we have power, because we would use it. They must know that we would use it, and they must know that they would lose if we use it, because they're very afraid of us doing so. But, you know, I don't even watch CNN anymore and MSNBC. I turn to the internet. The new media is where all the answers are.
The next question is from a man who says that it's a crime to cover all of this up. How could a conspiracy this big happen, and how does she reconcile this?
Well, I will tell you, when I was locked up in prison, and think about this, Andy Card is the chief of staff at the White House. Andy Card's cousin is locked in prison on a Texas military base, accused of incompetence, and I had friends contact Amy Goodman. And I bet you all love Amy Goodman, don't you? I don't like her at all. Amy Goodman, God bless her heart, apparently told, or her producer. I did not speak with her. My boyfriend spoke with her staff and begged them to do this story. And it should have been a big story. Amy Goodman said, apparently, "Oh, don't you think her attorney is like working on a strategy? I don't think we really want to interfere with her attorney's strategy if he thinks it's going to help her." Wow, Amy. You know, do I have a say in this? You know, do I get a say in whether I have a trial? I mean, the media was absolutely complicit. And when I was locked up, the New York Times had verified the story through four sources. Then they attended, while I was locked up, they contacted my father, who is a Republican. He is a serious Republican. I'm a serious Democrat. He's a Republican. But they said, "Why won't she use the drugs? Why won't she just help us out here and take those drugs? And why is she being so difficult? Can't you pressure your daughter?" And my father was like, you know, "I'm offended." You know, my father does not like my politics at all. But even he said that he was offended that the New York Times was trying to get me to cooperate. Why was I being difficult? 4 years after my indictment, I was under indictment for 5 years. The charges were dropped 5 days before Obama was inaugurated as president. In the fourth year, think about this, 4 years, I had a new private attorney, very high-flying, outstanding international attorney, recognized, could have torn down the Patriot Act. He could have done it. And he said that I was capable of assisting him in my defense and he would be happy to take my case. He went to the judge, he told this to the judge, and we were allowed to have one morning of testimony. We had two witnesses. One of them was a former congressional chief of staff who'd known me for years professionally. She was not a friend, she was a professional person who saw me and interacted with me. She said that she had never seen any sign of mental defect, and she knew my intelligence handler, Paul Hoven, personally. She knew he was tied in intelligence, and she knew absolutely we had a very deep, long relationship, and he talked about me all the time. We were obviously very close. And then the second witness was Park Godfrey, who testified in detail about the 9/11 warnings and how he absolutely confirmed it. He said that throughout the spring and summer of 2001, I talked about 9/11 as a reprise of the 1993 World Trade Center attack that would complete the cycle and would start a new war with Iraq. What he testified to was very important. Judge Prescott, the New York Times sat through that hearing knowing that I wanted a trial. And listen, if you have evidence and you can convict me, you can sentence me. So I was acknowledging that you would have the right to send me to prison for 10 years if you wanted to after you heard my testimony. But I wanted my day in court. The New York Times knew that. The lead sentence of the New York Times story was, "She stuck her tongue out at the prosecutor." What? Alan Feuer, F-E-U-E-R, Alan Feuer. I have never stuck my tongue out when I was in third grade. This was a court of law. Now, I may honestly have flipped the finger at the prosecutor, but I have never stuck my... In fact, I had a broken tooth at the time, and I was sitting right in front of the New York Times reporter. He could not have seen my face to know if I stuck my tongue out at the prosecutor. But he printed it as the lead of his story. And then he went on and regurgitated all this nonsense garbage that I was a religious fanatic. Now, I believe in God, like probably some of you here do. A lot of people maybe, because this is a church. I happen to believe in God. But I am not a religious crazy person. I just am not. My Aunt Susie, when I got out of prison, she said to me, "Well, I knew it was a lie when they said you were really religious because, you know, you just don't go around like quoting the Bible every day." I do believe in God. This is a church. I do believe in God. I want to confess that. That is true. But that is just like really outrageous to say that I was like hallucinating and having like wild, I wouldn't even know what that means.
You've just been listening to CIA whistleblower Susan Lindauer in Seattle in September of 2011. Tune in next week to hear the final part of her presentation. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.